Roundtable Osteuropa. Ein Podcast des Zentrums für Osteuropa und internationale Studien.
Welcome at SOES, a podcast that brings you insights into recent research in Eastern Europe. In the podcast episode today, we will speak about Ukrainians in Ukraine and abroad, their experiences of war and European integration, and what these may mean for the future of Ukrainian and European politics. Since President Yushchenko first declared EU integration as Ukraine's strategic foreign policy priority in 2005, the country's path to the EU has been thorny, marked by numerous ups and downs. Political instability, shifting leadership and pressure from Russia repeatedly tested Ukraine's European commitment. President Zelensky signed Ukraine's official EU membership application on the 28th February 2022, just 4 days after the start of Russia's full-scale invasion. Though the application was approved and Ukraine got EU candidate status unprecedentedly quickly, the path remains challenging and doesn't promise to be easier as the war continues and roughly 20% of Ukraine's territories are occupied by Russia. The recent book, Ukraine's Thorny Path to the EU, From Integration Without Membership to Integration Through War, co-edited by Dr. Anne Pinch from the University of Agder in Norway and myself, seeks to unpack the complexity of political, legal, and economic issues surrounding Ukraine's European integration in the war context. Today in the studio, we are fortunate to have Valeria Lazarenko and Konstantin Fedorenko, whose chapters deal with Ukrainian people and society. Valeria is a postdoctoral researcher affiliated with Georg Simmel Center for Urban Studies at the Humboldt University in Berlin, with her work focusing on the decision-making and time perspective of Ukrainian refugees in Germany. Konstantin finishes his PhD at SOES, focusing on motivation for emigration among the former Euromaidan participants. And my name is Marina Rabinovich. My current primary affiliation is with the Arctic University of Norway in Tromsø, and I'm also affiliated with Kiev School of Economics and an affiliated member of the SOES UNET network. I'll be your host today. Konstantin, let's start with you. Your chapter's title, Europe is not doing enough, points to the perceived lack of military aid as a potential driver of Euroscepticism among Ukrainians. How widespread is this sentiment, and how has it evolved since the war broke out?
So first of all, I'd like to say that military aid is probably not even the driving reason behind this increase in the levels of Euroscepticism among Ukrainians. Regarding the spread of this attitude, there's one seemingly paradoxical bit of statistics presented by the Kyiv International Institute for Sociology, who informed us that 90% of Ukrainians want Ukraine to become an EU member, but only 46% of Ukrainians feel actual trust towards the EU. So that's a significant gap, as you can see. And indeed, military aid at some point was an important reason. So we saw, according to other polls, that, for instance, Olaf Scholz was extremely mistrusted by Ukrainians in 2022. He had 54% negative attitudes in Ukraine-wide surveys, which was a significant drop from the late 2021 survey when Angela Merkel was named the most trusted, the most supported Western leader among Ukrainians, according to that same series of polls. So as to this evolution of sentiment, I can say that, for instance, again, using Olaf Scholz as an example, in February 2025, only 29% of Ukrainians have a negative attitude towards him, so almost a twofold decrease. But the issue is, how will this sentiment evolve once some semblance of a ceasefire and further a peace deal is reached? Further, the background behind this perceived lack of military aid among Ukrainians is, of course, the poor understanding of the historical scale of this aid provided by the Western countries. So if we actually look at the numbers, it's immense. It's quite comparable in the present US dollars to the scale of the land lease programs provided to the Soviet Union in World War II.
While military aspects are crucial, other aspects such as economic aid, sanctions policy, or Ukraine's EU accession process, which contribute to the Eurosceptic moods among Ukrainians.
Yes, there's a crucial point here. There is a discourse of moral superiority over the West due to the Ukrainian sacrifices in the war, due to many deaths, injuries, due to the displacement of millions of Ukrainians. And this discourse is, of course, in a way rooted in reality because, yes, Ukrainian people are the ones who directly actually lose life on the front lines and beyond them. Yet, this discourse is amplified and being imposed by the Ukrainian media and by the Ukrainian government as a political tool for bargaining in with the West, but also as a political tool of consolidating support among Ukrainians domestically. So there's an idea that the West is doing nothing or the West is doing too little. There's an idea that the West is relatively weak, and these ideas will be potentially very dangerous once normal political processes in Ukraine resume after some kind of a conclusion to this war. There's also poor information about the scale of EU's shift away from trade with Russia, in particular from Russian energy sources. So, for instance, many Ukrainians, when you talk to them, they're surprised to hear that Germany is almost not getting any energy sources from Russia these days. There's obviously a stereotype rooted in the past. Finally, there's general mistrust to international organizations as they proved unable to stop the Russian full-scale invasion. And this, of course, most clearly applies to the mistrust of Ukrainians towards the United Nations, but this spills over to other international institutions such as NATO or the supranational bodies of the European Union.
Valeria, and what do you think, speaking of the temporary protection for Ukrainians in Europe, what are the attitudes to this policy both among its beneficiaries and Ukrainians who have stayed in Ukraine amidst the whole war?
Oh, yeah. Hello. Firstly, I must do a little disclaimer and say that I'm less of a policy analyst, but more an anthropologist, and I work directly with the experiences and emotions of people who experience this, for instance, temporary protection for Ukrainians abroad. And I have been doing this research since 2022, and the main question that precise since that time is the question of time and the question of uncertainty and permanent temporariness in general. So mainly, how long is temporal and how long can people who are beneficiaries of this temporary protection remain in this status abroad? And as for now, the time frame of this protection lasts till 5th of March 2026. But the issue is that the Temporary Protection Directive was activated firstly for 2 years and then prolonged every year as an interim solution for the people experiencing this and living under this protection, which means that we're talking about more than 6 million of Ukrainians who applied for this temporary protection. And people who were living in the context of this uncertainty of how long will they be remaining in European Union countries, on which status, and what is going to happen with them afterwards. And on the recent conference, Cafe Kyiv in Berlin, there were lots of discussion about that. What will happen after temporary protection? And from what we have heard from German politicians, there is no clear solution, as countries, mainly Germany, who has attracted the biggest amount of Ukrainians, more than 1.2 million of Ukrainians, for now see them, and representatives of German Ministry of Interior were clearly stating that those people who wants to stay in Germany will have the opportunity to stay in Germany. But there are no clear policies on how this opportunity will be realized. What will be the policies, and will it be only seen as through job market integration, or what can be potentially the other solutions? And of course, another big issue to speak about are the integration efforts of the hosting countries, which actively promote the people who arrived from Ukraine to learn the language, to bring children to the schools, to integrate to job market, to integrate into the communities, which, as experienced by people who are the targets of these integration efforts, can be quite controversial. And as they may experience that the states, the hosting state, wants them to do something, and even to a certain extent to abandon their connections to the Ukrainian society. And this can lead to some emotional turmoils and conflicts, even conflicts of identities between the people coming from Ukraine. And also this evokes a certain very complex emotional complex that includes also the feelings of guilt and shame for being a bad citizen of Ukraine who left the country in the moment of need and being just a passive recipient of temporary protection and some social benefits in countries like Germany, and feeling also being disconnected from the people who have stayed in Ukraine. And of course, potentially this can lead to some conflicts between even family members or close friends whose life trajectories are drifting away when some people are abroad and the others are still in Ukraine and experiencing life and this war in a completely different way.
Yeah, and this resonates actually with what Christian Tin wrote in his chapter, and particularly the Eurosceptic claim of Ukraine's interests being impeded by European integration. So my next question goes to both you and Valeria. To what extent do you think this concern can be linked to demographic challenges, particularly as we see that the growing number of Ukrainian refugees express a desire to remain in the EU after the war and look for opportunities to do so, as Valeria said previously?
I can start with a bit of claim about all these surveys that growing amount of Ukrainians express their concern to remain in the European Union. This is my favorite part of criticizing the way the statistics is usually collected, because we may say that in 2022, the amount of people who were coming to European Union were a huge amount was claiming that they are coming to the EU just to sit over, to wait until the situation stabilizes, and then they, of course, plan to return to Ukraine. And now, if the same question is put into surveys again, more and more people, of course, say that they want to stay in European Union. But the question is that we also don't know the exact amount of those Ukrainians who have already returned. And there is quite a number. And the thing is that people who are returning, they usually do not renounce their status of temporary protection holders. So this statistic cannot be collected comprehensively. And de facto, we see that if we question people in the European Union who are already here, we are questioning those who made a decision to stay and not those who wanted to leave and left immediately. And it's quite hard to say with which number of people we are dealing in general. But of course, it all depends on also the return aspirations, of course, depend a lot on from which part of Ukraine the people are coming. And people from the currently occupied territories who have nowhere to return, or people from Kherson region, Zaporizhia region, which are the cities under constant shelling, it is a challenge for them to return. And even if they want to, it is very hard to estimate how realistic is this for now. And this is something of what my respondents of my research have mentioned a lot, that yes, they want, but technically it's not a way to go back, for instance, to Kherson. And speaking about the demographic challenges, it is also a very big issue about competition for the workforce and for the future generations from the hosting countries and Ukraine. And as we see a lot in Germany, the strategy of integrating Ukrainian refugees is deeply connected with job market integration, and people are seen as potential workforce. And even though the distribution of social benefits is attached to the job center and is administrated through Federal Agency for Work, while Ukrainian ministries, including the Ministry of Unity, also see these people as a potential resource for reconstructing the country. And living in this situation of the competition from both countries, when you as a person are kind of deprived of agency and is only seen as a workforce, can be quite challenging.
So I would like to approach this question from a different point of view. Ukraine as a state will be facing challenge of organizing elections abroad on an unprecedented scale. As it is, the elections for the Ukrainian diaspora were always an overcomplicated process that was dependent on consular registration that takes time. A lot of Ukrainians never register in the consulates. There are few time slots and there are very few ballot offices in each country. Now Ukraine will have millions of its citizens abroad, at least for the first elections after the war ends, and very likely for other elections to come. From now on, Ukraine's elections will be strongly affected by the diaspora, like for instance the vote in Moldova, where several times already the vote of its citizens abroad has decided the outcome of the elections or referenda. So the party in power in Ukraine will be tempted to restrict the access of Ukrainians abroad to the voting processes, since it's much harder to influence these voters abroad. And without them, the Ukrainian vote, for some of the reasons I named above, is risking to swing towards national populist attitudes.
And your point is actually quite linked to what we said earlier regarding the potential societal cleavages. Even if we speak about elections, there is a risk of what Yulia Tymoshenko named as the emergence of virtual Ukrainian nation, including a lot of people who would be staying abroad, even maybe missing a connection to Ukraine to a big extent, but still being able to influence the political landscape. So continuing this thought, do you think that this elections issue can itself impact the societal cleavages?
I believe in a way the very fact that millions of Ukrainians had entirely different lived experience for these crucial years as compared to people who live in Ukraine. So Ukrainians abroad were not under shelling, were not under risk of occupation, and so on and so forth. And many Ukrainians inside Ukraine currently feel that these people abroad don't actually have the right to speak for Ukraine, so they shouldn't affect the elections as much. There are voices in Ukraine that say, okay, Ukrainians who fled should not be allowed to vote in the future, especially if these were male Ukrainians. There's also an artificially created pressure from the government on the men abroad with regards to denying them consular services without proper military registration, which normally, or at least in many cases, requires physically visiting a draft office in Ukraine, which means you cannot come back to Europe again. So these people, for instance, are stuck in Europe without being allowed to get a passport, which also potentially nullifies their residence permits in these countries. And this was artificially created, as I say, by the government to create resentment towards the Ukrainians abroad from within Ukraine, to make some people within Ukraine happy that those who escaped, in quotation marks, also suffer in some way. And there were feelings of celebration among many Ukrainians once these decisions regarding men abroad were adopted by the Ukrainian Foreign Ministry, if we read the media comments and also the comments on the social media.
Yeah, so it's a very complicated matter, with this artificially created controversies between different groups of Ukraine. And also there was a recent research conducted by the, I think, Kyiv School of Economics about the polarization in Ukrainian society. The pressure in question behind this research was actually other really polarization and divisions in Ukrainian society. And are these divisions really so big? And I remember this research caused quite heated discussions in Ukrainian social media segments. And Timofey Brik, the sociologist and the rector of Kyiv School of Economics, pointed out that, yeah, polarization, it is not actually quite a polarization. It's just different opinions, and Ukrainians as a society has expressed this for many, many years, expressing controversial opinions about many, many things in the society, many societal issues. So maybe this polarization is not as present in the society itself as it is present in the discussions on the public levels. And to my opinion, and this is also a moment that we argue in our chapter with Marina, that it is important to see the Ukrainian diaspora not as something opposite to the Ukrainians who stayed in the country, but also as a different part of the nation. And also to see the people from the diaspora, and here this is also quite a big term, but by diaspora, I'm referring to all the Ukrainians who are living abroad now, and to see them not as those who must return as soon as it is safe to return to Ukraine, and if they do not return immediately, they are the traitors, but also as a resource and just another part of the nation that is currently residing abroad and maybe will remain abroad, but will remain also, they will also remain Ukrainians, and they will be triggering Ukrainian culture and advocating for Ukraine. And it is also important not to underestimate the role of diaspora here in the EU. All the people who are attending the demonstrations, the protests, keeping the visibility of the issue on public, it is also important. And one of the examples was the constant demonstrations here in Berlin, in Germany, of the Ukrainian community demanding to deliver some kind of ammunition. And it was visible. And it is hard to assess how much it impacted the political decisions. But I would say that it has this impact. And so, yeah, it is very hard to resolve the issue. And since Ukrainian, for instance, Ministry of Unity is promoting the idea that, oh, we should do some packages to attract people back to Ukraine, and this causes all these turmoils between the people who stayed in the country. Like, why should someone who spent 3 years in safety now receive 1 million of hryvnias while we stayed under the shelling and receive nothing? This is probably not the best solution to offer, but maybe seeing the diaspora members as also valuable part of Ukrainian community is more important, as at least at this point of time.
Yeah, but this, you actually preventively answered my next question as to the policy measures, as to what should be done by the Ukrainian government to address possible, if not the polarization, but at least the divisions and differences in experiences and attitudes people have developed over the 3 years. And maybe Konstantin also wants to comment on this and on what policy measures could have been useful for the Ukrainian government vis-a-vis its people in at this point of time.
So first of all, obviously, there was no need to create any artificial tension, indeed, between the Ukrainians that remain in Ukraine and Ukrainians abroad, because it's not like pressure on the diaspora would actually help getting those people back to Ukraine. Those people aren't going to come back if you attempt to pressure and blackmail them into doing so. Second, also, as Valeria said, yes, promoting lucrative return schemes might help Ukraine demographically, because a number of Ukrainians might return if there's a positive stimulus to do so, but it also might backfire because people in Ukraine will be feeling left out by these policies while they actually suffered more in their day-to-day life. Now, attempting to pressure people into returning will also increase cleavage because the presence of this issue in the media constantly heats up this question of different lived experiences, different attitudes of Ukrainians abroad and Ukrainians at home. The other challenge that Ukrainian government could face is the potential emergence of the modern stab-in-the-back myth of the traitorous allies that did not supply enough assistance to Ukraine and that potentially pressured Ukraine to conditions of an unsustainable ceasefire or an unsustainable peace deal. And mitigating these concerns, mitigating this myth is very important in ways of the government not pressuring, first of all, for this agenda, because right now there are definitely notes of the West that is not helping enough and that's not sufficiently on the side of Ukraine. That's a risk for the emergence of future national populist and far-right narratives in Ukraine. The other thing, of course, is to positively underline the common goals of Ukraine and the West in this war. That would be a task not only for the government but also for the Ukrainian media. That's also very important from the point of view of journalistic responsibility for what comes next for Ukraine after the war and for the constructive relationship with the Western allies as well as the moderate and constructive political discussion at home in Ukraine. And there's also a question of military veterans versus civilians in Ukraine, which is extremely delicate. It's very hard to advise upon. I believe that there will be a need to create a number of consultancy groups that would involve the various stakeholders from both groups to develop some kind of a discourse that would concentrate on the common experiences, common feelings, common beliefs, rather than what divides these two groups. Because as it is, we do need to consider that as after all wars, particularly wars that were not perceived as being totally won, there's an issue of radicalization among some veterans. There's an issue of some veterans who return to civilian life and don't find their place there. Some of them have lost their families during the war because the families could not go on without them for a long while. Some of them, many of them actually, have lost their civilian job, some of them job skills. It is quite possible that they will face some negative attitudes from some employers, and Ukraine will need to develop a very, very careful and delicate policy of reintegrating those veterans into civilian life and of representing them on the national level, but doing so in a way that will be balanced with the interests and representation of civilians.
And do you think, can the EU contribute to fostering societal cohesion among Ukrainians, both within Ukraine, as Konstantin just argued, and across the diaspora?
Yeah, for sure. The EU role can be crucial here. And like first point that we need to think about is about actually the accession of Ukraine to the EU and when will it happen. And if it happens soon after the ceasefire, then the policies will be completely different and it will be even harder to foster these special programs of Ukrainians returning to Ukraine if they will be already the European citizens. But since it is more about wishful thinking about Ukraine accessing the European Union in a sooner perspective. At the moment, also many talks are going on about the issues like dual citizenship and dual intent of reintegration of Ukrainians. And speaking from a German perspective, it has also been seen that those who have, with the new German citizenship law that's just came to action last year, and we don't know for how long will it be still here with the current developments in politics. But still, there can be an vision that people who have been living in Germany for 3 years, working, contributing to social security payments, and have passed the German level test on a C1 level, can apply for the citizenship after 3 years of living in the country. And this is what is already happening with Ukrainians who have been in Germany for 3 years. At the same time, in the Ukrainian parliament, there has also been talks about allowing dual citizenship in Ukraine. So this, it is all a processual issue that can happen and can change all the time. But also what EU can do is not only offering direct support for people who are returning in terms of like money and travels and reimbursement for the costs, but more probably supporting the return of skills and knowledge to Ukraine. Because, for instance, we can talk about people who came to the EU with kids, and kids were reintegrated to EU schools that have very different program and approach to schooling and to education in general, that for some people might seen as better than in Ukraine. And the reason for people to stay here, so children receive the EU education and not go back to Ukrainian schools. So probably some programs on improving or bringing Ukrainian education more to EU standards will be something that can stimulate not only parents of the children to return to Ukraine, but also educators and people who were employed in the education system for some time. And also, since so many people, millions of people, gain some additional experience in the EU, for instance, experience of activism and working in civil society organizations, their skills can also be seen as something useful for Ukraine. And maybe some joint programs about changing some standards, systems in Ukraine in accordance to the EU, and also aimed to fostering Ukraine's accession to the EU, can have some benefits in a long-time perspective. And of course, I will emphasize this point again, that also those who will not return to Ukraine, who will remain in the EU, should be seen as not lost for the country, but as a valuable asset for the country, and as those who can potentially return or be in the advocates for Ukraine in the EU countries, like it happened with people immigrating from Poland, Lithuania in early 2000s, who were a powerful diaspora in the EU and have returned to their countries after some years when it became more, when they felt like that, and when the situation in their home countries changed.
So from my point of view, in order to avoid the rise in national populism and economic populism in a post-war Ukraine, the European Union will need to be extremely visible in reconstruction aid. So for instance, every reconstruction project, every infrastructural project will need to have visible shields with EU flags, with some spends on these projects, and so on and so forth. We know from different countries that these shields actually help increase the support towards the EU among the local population. Then also communicating clear and transparent conditionality and membership pathway from the side of the European Union, the EU institutions will be crucial. So at this point, we actually have a decent track in this direction. And I believe it will be of utmost importance that this track of clear communication to the Ukraine with regards to membership perspectives will need to be preserved. Most importantly, there will be a need to avoid the limbo that, for instance, Western Balkan countries have stayed in for about a decade by now. So when the countries have been repeatedly offered membership sometime in the future, but actually not seen their progress towards this goal, or having, for instance, some minutiae of political conflict between countries, like, for instance, between Greece and Northern Macedonia, and then Bulgaria and Northern Macedonia with regards to historical issues. This obviously decreases the trust towards the European Union. This obviously increases the power of the Eurosceptic politicians within these countries. And that's a risk for Ukraine as well if the integration steps are not transparently communicated, but also if Ukraine stalls a lot on one of these steps.
Yeah, thank you. And I know this question is probably overambitious, but I think we would end our podcast with it. So how would you envision Ukrainian society in the post-war future? And do you think what role the European integration would play in the broader realm of societal development in Ukraine?
So I would start with a bit of a negative perspective, since my chapter concentrates on risks for Ukraine. Ukraine will objectively face a demographic crisis as millions of its citizens will remain in Europe. Probably Ukraine will not be able to liberate its internationally recognized territory to the full scale by the end of this phase of the war. Ukraine will be facing an economic crisis which is less visible and less felt now, as many citizens are concentrated on immediate survival, but which will be a central point after the fighting ends. Ukraine's facing an infrastructural crisis, as obviously its infrastructure has been damaged by constant shelling, but also Ukrainian government obviously could not afford the necessary repairs to this infrastructure in these past years. Ukraine will also face this issue of veterans not finding place for themselves in civilian life and feeling treated in an unjust way. As always, as in any war, or rather after any war, with all the best people that are on the front lines for Ukraine right now, there will be some of the veterans that will contribute to the rise in crime and arms trade. That is something every country after the conflict has observed. And then there will be a major crisis of trust in the West if sustainable peace is not achieved, because all these problems can actually be solved only in case if Ukraine knows what happens next, what happens in half a year, what happens in a year or two, so that it will not be invaded once again by Russia. It will not be decimated by a repeated conflict. Nobody is going to invest into a Ukraine that could be destroyed in several years once Russia attacks once again. So the most important contribution that the European Union and European integration could play in Ukraine's societal development is this pressure for sustainable peace that will allow Ukraine to redevelop, to rebuild, and potentially build back better. And this certainty that European integration that could be well communicated, could be very transparent, could provide to the Ukrainian society, this will also be the best antidote, the best remedy to the discourses of national populism and economic populism that would be saying, okay, but European integration impedes Ukrainian interests, but possibly we could rebuild faster without the European Union. If people will see that the European integration, that all the steps towards approximation, that European infrastructural aid really helps them improve their lives on a day-to-day basis, then these populist narratives will be undermined, and that will be for the better of Ukraine, for the better of Ukraine's future interests. Thank you.
Thank you, Konstantin.
Yeah, and I will briefly add that, like, to me, it looks more about a question of money, who will pay and how the reconstruction of Ukraine will be paid, with which assets. And, of course, it's a question of potential confiscation and usage of Russian active that can be redirected to the rebuild of Ukraine. And this is something which is being currently advocated by the EU, but it's still a very controversial issue. And yeah, we don't know how it will happen and when and what will happen. But yeah, the issue goes on about, like, the money and the programs potentially financed by EU. And what Konstantin mentioned, the programs on DDR, disarmament, demobilization, reintegration for the veterans, which will also need lots of money to be delivered into that, but also creating some additional workplaces for the people who will be working there. The psychologists, the specialists in peace building who will be employed in this sphere. And at the same time, it is a question of hard rebuilding, rebuilding of the infrastructure of everything that was damaged, which requires lots of finance resources, but also creates certain amount of workplaces. And the question is also how these workplaces be paid and by whom. And potentially if there will be, like, let's envision some EU-financed programs with the salaries being quite comparable to the salary level in the European Union, this is something that can potentially attract Ukrainians back to the country because such programs can guarantee them certain way of life. And but also it is a question of immigration to Ukraine from the other country. And this is something which is slowly starting to be a point of discussion. What will Ukraine as a country do if Ukrainians from abroad do not want to return? And also as potentially after the war, Ukraine will have a shortage of men of working age to work on the hard job in construction. Who will fill these positions? And here is a question of attracting people from other countries to work there on rebuilding on Ukraine. And to me, it is a bit sad to see that this idea is sometimes discussed in a negative way in Ukrainian society, as it is something bad. But to my opinion, we need to just restrain ourselves from thinking in ethno-nationalistic terms of what Ukraine is. And yeah, attracting people from other countries can also be beneficial, as we see in the examples from the other countries recovering from the war, starting from Germany and up to South Korea. And there are many examples when influx of migrants also enriched the country and helped the economical and societal development in the future. But yeah, the question of money and financialization, of course, will be persisting. And here I see the crucial role of the European Union, not only in investing money directly, but also in managing and administrating some money flows, mitigating the risks of corruption, and so on.
Thank you very much. This was an insightful discussion, which touched upon many topics, and indeed, under the war and in the post-war period, Ukraine is and will remain a laboratory for many, many things, starting from reconstruction up to European integration, the management of migration, relations with the diaspora, using assets and hopefully also the justice processes, something which is very much needed for a country which has experienced an invasion of such a scale in a contemporary world in the 21st century. Thank you very much.